Welcome to SCOTUSCast, the Federalist Society's podcast providing analysis on current cases of the U.S. Supreme Court. I'm Haley Reynolds, here to introduce Dr. Robert Levy for a special edition. The case Dr. Levy will discuss, Parker v. District of Columbia, has not yet been heard by the Supreme Court, but appears to be heading that direction. On March 9th, the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals issued a landmark ruling, holding that the district's 32-year-old gun ban is unconstitutional, interpreting the Second Amendment to protect an individual, as opposed to collective, right to keep and bear arms. All other circuits except the Fifth, who have addressed this question, have disagreed with this interpretation, and D.C. is the first circuit to employ the Second Amendment to strike down a gun regulation. Dr. Levy was responsible for planning, bringing, and funding the entire Parker case. He is currently a senior fellow at the Cato Institute, but this case was his own independent endeavor. He will now provide his analysis on the decision and his predictions for the case's future.
It's a pleasure to participate in the Federalist Society's SCOTUSCast program. Today's podcast is about the Second Amendment and gun control, and more specifically, about Parker v. District of Columbia, a blockbuster opinion released on March 9, 2007 by the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit. Parker was a straightforward constitutional challenge to D.C.'s draconian gun laws. The case was filed by lead counsel Alan Gurra, two other lawyers, and myself, on behalf of six law-abiding D.C. residents who want to possess functional firearms to defend themselves where they live and sleep. Parker is not about machine guns and assault weapons. It's about to own ordinary garden-variety handguns, and the Parker plaintiffs didn't ask for the right to carry a gun outside the home. The Parker litigation simply is about a pistol in the home for self-defense. Before the district banned handguns in 1976, the murder rate had been declining, but soon afterward, the rate climbed to the highest of all large U.S. cities, and during the 31-year life of the D.C. gun ban, with the exception of a few years during which the city's murder rate ranked second or third, there have been more killings per capita in D.C. than in any other major city. But no handgun can be registered in D.C. Even pistols registered prior to the district's 1976 ban can't be carried from room to room in the home without a license, which is never granted. And furthermore, all firearms in the home, including rifles and shotguns, have to be unloaded and either disassembled or bound by a trigger lock. So in effect, no one in the district can possess a functional firearm in his or her own residence. And the law applies not just to unfit persons like felons, minors, and mentally incompetent, but across the board to ordinary, honest, responsible citizens. There have been more than three dozen challenges to the D.C. ban already filed, but mostly by criminals serving longer sentences for gun possession. Now, the Parker case is different. The lead plaintiff, Ms. Shelley Parker, lived in a high-crime neighborhood in the heart of the district. People on her block were harassed relentlessly by drug dealers and addicts. She decided to do something about it. She called the police time and again. She encouraged her neighbors to do the same. She organized block meetings to discuss the problem. And for her audacity, Shelley Parker was labeled as a troublemaker by the dealers, and they threatened her at every opportunity. She wanted to possess a functional handgun within her home for self-defense, but she feared arrest and prosecution because of D.C.'s unconstitutional gun ban. For several reasons, Washington, D.C. was a unique and appropriate venue for the lawsuit. First, the city's rate of gun violence is among the highest in the nation, yet the city has the most restrictive gun laws of any major city. Second, until 1868, when the 14th Amendment was ratified, the Bill of Rights applied only to the federal government. Unlike most of the other 10 amendments, the applicability of the Second Amendment to the states has not been resolved. But that complex and widely debated question need not be addressed when a Second Amendment challenge is raised in Washington, D.C. That's because the federal government is constitutionally empowered to exercise exclusive legislation in all cases whatsoever over the nation's capital. Third, felonies under D.C. law are prosecuted by the U.S. Attorney for the District of Columbia. He's an employee of the Justice Department, the same Justice Department that is now on record favoring an individual rights theory of the Second Amendment. To make a long story short, the Parker plaintiffs have prevailed in the D.C. Circuit. Senior Judge Lawrence Sultan, joined by Judge Thomas Griffith, over a dissent by Judge Karen Henderson, held that the Second Amendment protects an individual right to keep and bear arms. And the court continued, the activities that are protected by the amendment, and I quote, are not limited to militia service, nor is an individual's enjoyment of the right conditioned upon his or her continued or intermittent enrollment in the militia, close quote. In fact, said the court, the right to arms existed even prior to the formation of the new government in 1789. So for those of us who are eagerly awaiting a comprehensive Supreme Court statement on the Second Amendment, the D.C. Circuit has held that the Constitution is on our side. That doesn't mean the D.C. government is powerless in terms of regulating the use and ownership of firearms. Judge Silberman conceded that the protections of the Second Amendment are subject to the same sort of reasonable restrictions that have been recognized as limiting, for instance, the First Amendment. Perhaps, said Judge Silberman, D.C. could justify concealed carry restrictions, registration of firearms, proficiency testing, and no gun possession by felons or minors. But, he added, an across-the-board ban on all handguns in all homes for all residents simply isn't reasonable. In fact, it's not a regulation at all. It's an out-and-out prohibition. The proponents of gun control are not persuaded by those arguments, nor are they persuaded by the text of the Second Amendment, the history, the purpose, the structure of the Constitution, or even the intent of the framers. The enactment of any gun regulations has become an article of faith in some cities and states. The regulations persist, they even spread in the face of compelling legal and policy arguments for their demise. But the right to keep and bear arms is essential to sustain a free society, and the Constitution, said the D.C. Circuit, does not permit our government to take the right away. So, where do we go from here? First, D.C., the loser in this case, will ask for rehearing by the whole court. We don't think the court will grant rehearing, nor do we think that D.C. will prevail if there is a rehearing. But those are, we admit, close calls. Either way, the next step will be a petition for review by the Supreme Court. That, too, is a close call, as is the outcome if the court does take the case. But there's a complication on the horizon. Representatives Mike Ross, Democrat from Arkansas, and Mark Souder, a Republican from Indiana, have introduced H.R. 1399, the D.C. Personal Protection Act. And Senator Kay Bailey Hutchison is about to introduce a similar bill in the Senate. Inexplicably, the NRA is vigorously pushing both bills, and those bills essentially would repeal the D.C. handgun ban. Ordinarily, that might be a good thing. But in this instance, passage of the D.C. Personal Protection Act would kill the Parker litigation. It simply isn't possible to challenge a law that has been repealed. And yet, there are important reasons why the Parker case is a much better vehicle to vindicate Second Amendment rights than an act of Congress is. First, the new legislation will not foreclose appeals by criminals of sentences for gun crimes. Indeed, defense lawyers in D.C. would be committing malpractice if they didn't cite Parker for that purpose. Those appeals will inevitably lose, but when four liberals on the Supreme Court decide that the time is right to grant certiorari, the court will be greeted by crackheads and bank robbers as poster boys for the Second Amendment. Second, even though the rights of D.C. residents can be secured by either legislation or litigation, a narrow bill aimed at D.C. would do only part of the job. The bill could be repealed by the next anti-gun Congress, and more important, the bill will have no effect on state law outside of the District of Columbia. And that means, of course, the bill will have negligible impact on gun owners' rights, especially when contrasted with an unambiguous proclamation applicable across the nation from the U.S. Supreme Court. Third, the court is probably as pro-Second Amendment today as it's likely to be for some time. And even if the court should mistakenly hold that the Second Amendment provides a collective right rather than an individual right, that would be the time for Congress to ensure that D.C. residents have more protection than the judicial branch was willing to recognize. Until then, the D.C. Personal Protection Act is premature and it's counterproductive. If Congress wants to help, there are positive things it can do. D.C. has no federal firearms licensees, and handguns, unlike rifles and shotguns, can't be purchased out of state. So even if Parker wins, D.C. residents could not buy a handgun. That's an area that Congress can address. Allow interstate handgun sales. Moreover, Congress should look at how D.C. processes gun registrations. The city doesn't follow the National Instant Criminal Check System, or NICS, N-I-C-S. Instead, D.C. requires multiple pictures, fingerprints, a list of all addresses used in the past 5 years, and on and on. The process can take months. Congress should force D.C. officials to accept the NICS system used everywhere else. And finally, the NRA has suggested on its website that the D.C. Personal Protection Act is must legislation. Why? Because the courts move too slowly and time is of the essence. If that's the case, where has the NRA been for 31 years since the D.C. handgun ban was enacted? Why is it only now that legislation must be passed, especially when the effect of that legislation will be to kill the best chance ever for the Supreme Court to affirm that the Second Amendment means what it says?